Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence by Jane's. Harry Kemsley is your host, and as usual, Sean Corbett, my co-host. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Harry.
So, Sean, you and I have been speaking, I can't actually count how many times, about what you call the High North, the Arctic region. We're going to have a conversation about that. And to help us, I've invited a colleague from Jane's, James Rand. Hello, James.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Good. Can you just, for the audience, give us a one-liner on what your role is in Jane's?
I've been here 6 years. I'm now on the country intelligence team covering some of Eastern Europe, other regions, and military capabilities.
Perfect. Thank you. For those that would like to see a bit more about James's background, James, that's going to be confusing to get that right today.
My spell check keeps on changing both.
I'm sure. I'll put the bio in the link to the podcast for the audience who want to see it. All right. High North. So, Sean, topic of great interest to you and others, I know.
Indeed, yeah.
Can just for the audience give us a very quick overview? What do we mean by the High North and why is it important? And James, I'll get you to join us as we go along.
Okay. So the reason I call it the High North rather than the Arctic, which is some terminology and people do interchange it, but it's to really reflect the fact that it's far more strategic than just the eight Arctic nations. And, you know, the Arctic itself is quite well defined. The High North, not so much, but for me, it reflects the strategic importance of it and the fact that anything that happens there has got global implications. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the Arctic states that are very interested in it. You've got a whole diversity of nations that really care about it, you know, including China, of course, but even to countries like Turkey, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason it's important and the reason they're interested in it is several issues, really. One is the climate change, which is developing potentially a northern sea route that will be open in 10 years, probably, you know, it depends on what your calculation is, but certainly parts of the year, the northern sea route across the top there will be open. Now, that has all sorts of trade implications, et cetera. And you've heard China talk about the Northern Silk Road and stuff like that. So this really matters for them, and they are planning accordingly, which we'll come to in a moment. But it's not just about the routes; it's also about the natural resources that are there. Again, opening up, there is a huge amount of oil and gas reserves, and as much of that there, they reckon that I think it's up to 30% of the world's untapped rare earth minerals are in that part of the world. So there's a very big economic elements to it. But the other thing I think, and you've heard me say this before, when you take any strategic issue that you're interested in, if you put the center of it at the center of a global map, you'll just see how different dynamically it is. And the North kind of joins up a lot of these big strategic players. And the final reason is that geography still matters. So when you've got things like satellites, they tend to work in, without getting into too much detail, sun synchronous orbits. So that is where they go over, the North Pole and the South Pole. And then, of course, it's the least distance between two lines for things like intercontinental ballistic missiles. So it really matters.
Right. James?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting point there that we've got a confluence of a few different things. Sean talked about how the ice is melting. There are new sea routes opening up, and that's making it a lot easier to extract some of these mineral elements. So whereas 10 years ago, it just simply wouldn't have been economically viable to extract rare earth elements from Sweden, where there's a big find just happened. Now we have a mine in Canada, in the High North, which is extracting these. Mm. We have learned how to do it. I haven't, but you know, the technical experts have learned how to do it. The machinery has been built. Challenges have been overcome. And now rolling out a second plant is relatively straightforward. So suddenly it's much more economically viable to do this. Sure. There are more places we can physically get to. And the value of some of these products is going up hugely. One estimate was between 2020 and 2030, the total demand for rare earth elements, which are used in some modern technology, would increase by 5 times. Hmm. So clearly the value is going to increase as well. So cheaper to get it out of the ground, and you can sell it for more, and there's more of it available.
Yeah.
And oil and gas, of course, is going up all the time as well. So that becomes more viable. And then on top of that, you have got the fact that different countries are laying different claims There are some historical claims, which some of which just never really mattered because it was all under ice. So the moot point, who owns it?
Yeah.
But as things start to open up, suddenly it becomes a little bit more relevant.
Presumably international borders, international sea navigation and so on, when those seas open up, that also becomes, I mean, previously you wouldn't have cared because it was frozen.
Yeah.
Now that it's open, it means you can navigate through it.
Absolutely.
And proximity to, well, let me come back to you to help me understand, remember, what are the eight states that form up the, that part of the world, Sean? But, I mean, those eight states presumably have a view about where their borders are.
Absolutely. So they're entitled to 12 nautical miles by international law.
Yeah.
That is from their coastline. Some of them disagree where their coastline actually ends,
right,
because the coast is not a straight line.
Yeah.
So sometimes they say, actually, this is an inland sea, this is a bay, our border starts at the mouth of that.
Right.
But they also can lay claim to continental shelf. So there is a shallow part of the sea,
yeah,
and eventually that drops off.
Yeah.
And just to complicate that even further, there's a thing called the Article 234 of the UN Convention of Law of the Sea, which, again, interpretable, but it permits states to enact enhanced control measures in exclusive economic zones when year-round ice is present. So that's the sort of thing that the Russians are using to say, well, I can, you know, explore where I want to. Of course, with the ice receding, how does that impact that?
So where previously they would have said that was part of my permanent ice and therefore within my border, where the ice is no longer permanent or indeed disappeared, there is an argument to be had.
Open to interpretation.
Open to interpretation. Yep. And so I suspect that will foment friction.
Absolutely. And there are already conflicting claims. Both Denmark through Greenland, obviously not through Denmark itself, and Russia are laying claim to areas in the North Pole that overlap because they reckon their version of their continental shelf extends that far.
Right.
They could, I think, I'm not a geologist, but I think they could both be right. But an interesting question would be who would actually decide that?
But nonetheless, if they're both right and they're therefore both wrong in each other's eyes, then you're waiting for a
battle
on your heads. Sean, what are the eight countries?
So the eight countries are Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the USA.
Yeah.
Now that's the actual eight Arctic, but already the diplomatic community is bigger than that. There's a thing called the Arctic Council that was established in 1996, which includes more nations than that. Now, all those nations, particularly the Arctic nations, for good reasons actually, have underplayed the Arctic as a potential for any tension. They call it Arctic exceptionalism. Now that's fine, and what they tend to talk about is things like search and rescue, you know, peaceful means, environment, et cetera, et cetera. But what it doesn't stop, and we might get onto that later, is most of these nations are developing military capabilities that can actually...
So the reason I'm probing around a bit here is because what you're describing to me is an area of the world in which there is good economic reasons to be fully present, dominating to some extent. There are countries who believe they, quote, own that and have done so for time immemorial because it's been under ice. There is ambiguity about what the rules are in terms of how you interpret it. All that just feels like a perfect storm waiting to happen in terms of multiple actors believing they have good reason to believe they own things and other actors disagreeing with that. But as these things become more and more scarce, as these lanes open up, I want to navigate the Chinese, want to put their ships through there, transiting through Russia, do they put tariffs on Chinese traffic? You know, these sort of things just feel like they're just bubbling away, trying to get to the point where nobody will understand anything other than the need for conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to envisage a scenario where a new route is opened up through the ice. The international community as a whole decides that that is an international sea lane. That's probably not quite the correct legal term, but there are...
Yeah.
There are lanes which everyone is
allowed. We hear about it all the time, don't we? Between China and Taiwan, and the US and other nations sail through it.
Exactly. And the nation nearest says no. The one we tend to think about is Russia, but actually it wouldn't necessarily have to be Russia that was saying no, or it could be someone saying no to Russia. And we can then see civilian shipping being harassed by naval shipping to try and put it back on course. And... yeah, that has a lot of scope to go very horribly wrong very quickly.
I remember, although it's completely different, I remember the fish wars between Iceland and the UK, where the scenes of ships battering into each other. That could get quite nasty quite quickly. All right, so let's press on then. Let's assume that tensions have started to rise. What are the things we're going to be looking for to get us to the point where we start to be really concerned about the High North in terms of those indicators? What are we looking for in an open source environment? And what are some of those triggers that might actually drive us that way?
Well, I think one of the complexities in the High North is that you can't just move troops in from elsewhere.
Right.
So normally, if we were looking for an increase in tensions, we'd see brigades being moved up to the border, jets being moved into the air bases, you know, within striking distance of the border. But actually, to operate in the High North is challenging. I know we're going to talk about that later. But also prepping your kit is difficult. So as just an example, mineral oils and lubricants typically work down to about minus 20 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
We are talking about temperatures a lot lower than that in some parts of the High North. And therefore, you need to put, I have written down the name of this, I will not pronounce it correctly, polyalpha olefin, PAO, based synthetic lubricants. So you've got to clear out the engines of your vehicles, put these things in, which will work up to down to minus 50. That's not something that's going to...
Presumably, then, you're also going to have... I mean, if you took an average truck or average piece of equipment, whatever that is, and tried to use it consistently in Arctic conditions, it's going to fail for other reasons too, right?
Yeah.
There are all kind of components that won't want to work at that kind of temperature.
Absolutely, yeah.
So would it be fair to say you could also look for indicators of specialist equipment being procured in larger and larger numbers?
Absolutely, yeah. Right. So
do we see any of that already?
Well, at the moment, the UK and the US are both buying BAE winter mobility vehicles. You may well be aware of the old BV-109,
the
two-part tracked vehicle.
Yeah, sort of the Falklands, I think.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So they're hinged vehicle, a bit like trains with tracks. They offer moving troops and equipment around in a very extreme environment. To get around in snow and ice, heavy snow and ice, you either want tracks or you want big wheels, possibly slightly lower pressure than you'd have on the road. So there are vehicles built for the Arctic. We know the US and the UK are buying them at the moment. Russia is obviously preoccupied at the moment, but they are developing two divisional headquarters in the St. Petersburg area. Now those are going to be probably headquarters, divisions in name only, headquarters of a few units for a while yet. We'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later if we wish to. But we also see a lot of investment in naval equipment. So China at the moment is building icebreakers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, icebreakers have civilian uses, lots of civilian uses, but they are also used in support of the military. And Russia has quite a large fleet of icebreakers, as you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
Which had run the range from purely civilian to military, and a big grey area in between civilian vessels with weapons on and what have you. China's icebreakers will come online in 2030, is their estimate. There's quite a long lead time to get these in. So we shouldn't really expect them to be engaging in any offensive actions in the High North before then. They have carried out joint exercises with the Russians in around the Bering Straits.
Naval exercises,
right. Yeah. So we see that sort of tension. We see a build-up. We also see bases being built. Now, a lot of the bases that are being built are for very specific purposes. So there's air defence bases. And because this is the shortest path for a ballistic missile from Russia into the North America and vice versa, it makes perfect sense that we would have intercept stations and we would have sensor stations in that area. Of course, if you're building that, you could also build other more offensive capabilities in the same area. And Nagaskoye airstrip, which is at 80 degrees latitude, pretty high up, which is a Russian base, has an airstrip. Now, we don't know exactly what's based there permanently, but we know jets can land. Now, jets obviously are part of your layered air defence, but they're also part of your offensive capability.
Sure.
So we're seeing that growing And we're seeing that upgrading on all sides. We're also seeing, I mean, shenanigans is probably about the most technical way of describing it. So
unusual operations.
Yeah, exactly. There's Svalbard, which is a base where satellites signals are brought in. It's up in the high north. And I think it was last year, Sean could probably correct me, one of the two main cables was cut. Now, initially, there was a suggestion that maybe a trawler had caught the cable. Yeah. The section of cable that was ripped out and moved quite some distance weighed 8.5 tons.
That's a big fish.
Yeah. It seems unlikely that any fisherman got that caught and was mistaken about what happened.
Yeah.
So it seems very likely that that was. It seems more likely than not that that
was deliberate. Well, the theoretical perpetrator, and who's the victim of this? Who cares that that's been cut?
Well,
so Svalbard is probably the interesting one in terms of the litmus, because it's owned by Norway, but there's an agreement between them and Russians in particular that, you know, hands off, we just live and let live, really. But the Russians have been doing some quite dodgy SF exercises around there. In terms of cable cutting, you know, discuss, but almost certainly the Russians.
Right.
You know, even if it's just rehearsals for other stuff.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Because there are other cables in the world that could be.
There are many other cables, yeah. Mm. But I didn't mean to interrupt, sorry.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But going back to the INW, indicators and warning, it is a classic, brilliant case study for open source intelligence in terms of your indicators and warnings. You know, threat equals capability plus intent plus opportunity. So if you look at the capability developments, as James has mentioned, you know, I think already they've got something like 40-odd icebreakers, the Russians, with another 15 coming on board. You've got the Chinese developing theirs. The US right now have 2, but are actually trying to catch up. So, you know, and that's another point worth reiterating, is that just because it's not going to be covered with ice the whole year doesn't mean say it's not an extremely demanding environment. It's still pretty long. So you've got to have specialist equipment. So the capability development is really interesting, and you know, particularly interested in James's thoughts about the bases up there, because it's going to be almost impossible to have permanent bases. But we've seen in the past, Rogacheva and places like that, where, you know, Russian aircraft have come up and they've gone on a deployment, don't stay for too long and disappear again. Of course, Russian aircraft are pretty good at operating on steer bases. They still have to get their own rivets, so they don't have quite the same tech that can go wrong. So the more that they rehearse that, practice that. Again, I think James also mentioned the command and control. So the Northern Fleet's now a military district. Mm-hmm. So combined arms, that gives it much more power than it ever used to. So, you know, you've got everything from the political rhetoric to making the abnormal normal by more deployments and the Svalbard thing, you know, so you sort of, you drive things sort of, you know, it becomes more normal, so you're not looking at it as much. But someone has to keep looking at this to see where the trigger point is. I liked your 2030 thing for the Chinese, because that for me would be a timescale that we really need to be interested. But of course, you can't just suddenly go, oh, it's 2030. What's happening over here?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I know we discussed this offline, but looking at those two divisions that Russia's building, my estimate is that once they pull their troops back from Ukraine, it's going to take about 4 and 5 years to have those properly online. They've got to bring in troops, get them trained for the environment, do their basic training first, get them trained for the environment, get them equipped with the right equipment, and then start building up through battalion and regiment and then divisional exercises. So they won't have them ready overnight. And we'll get to track that. We'll see their exercises on Facebook, and we'll see their exercises on in the Russian media. So we'll get to track that. But they will build that capability up, and potentially around 2030, they will have an infantry force looking into Scandinavia.
Yeah, and we've got presumably corresponding force build-ups or force development plans in other nations.
Yeah, you have, and that includes the West as well. So it'd be very wrong to say that, you know, we're walking into this blindfold, because you've seen that. Well, there's a a UK maritime Arctic strategy. There's a US Coast Guard and naval strategy as well. So, what's positive for me is that the, you know, the Western forces, if you like, are aware of this. Never been a particularly big discussion within NATO because there are sensitivities, you know, for some of the nations, because it's like, hang on, this is our backyard. And by the way, exceptionalism, don't get involved. But actually that reality now is starting to really impact into the way people are developing it. So, and then you mentioned the Chinese as well, of course, and other nations too. So, you know, I think people are alive to it, but you still need to keep monitoring it. Now, the final thing I'll say on that is that, you know, if it wasn't everything else that was going on in the world, I'd be really concerned now. But clearly the bandwidth, the capacity for China's this world.
Also, if they might deploy into two divisions, are probably not available for other reasons.
Absolutely, yeah. Exactly that. Yeah. Exactly. And there's only so much you can focus on. So the political dynamic is obviously very major in this, and whether that's the rhetoric, whether that is people, you know, putting in new claims to the UN, we'll see it ramping up and ramping up before it ends.
I think there's another strategic dimension to this. We've seen Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Yeah. Obviously, that has changed our border. We now have, NATO now has a border with Russia, a longer border with Russia.
Yeah.
We get tens of thousands of extra, NATO gets tens of thousands of extra troops who are trained in that environment and relatively used to it, hundreds of thousands if you include all the Finnish reserves.
Yeah. Yeah.
1,000 artillery pieces. But perhaps most significantly, it changes our relationship, or changes the West's relationship with the Baltic states.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Baltic states are something that clearly the current Russian government would like to take back under control. If they were to launch a sudden lightning strike into the Baltic, there's not a lot of depth there. They probably could reach the coast pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
2 or 3 days is not unrealistic,
mm-hmm.
at which point they would be presenting NATO with a fait accompli, and NATO would have to make some tough decisions about whether it actually wanted to go back in and fight there. Now, NATO's response has been to put a battle group in each of those countries, drawn from NATO, so that any Russian assault ultimately kills troops from across NATO. I mean, hopefully that unit fights and slows down the Russian advance, but realistically, even if it doesn't, it has achieved a strategic effect of bringing the whole of NATO in. But that's what's there. If that failed, the only way that NATO previously would be getting up to the Baltics to reinforce them would be either through the Svarki Gap, I hope I pronounced that correctly, but the gap between Kaliningrad and Belarus,
mm-hmm.
narrow piece of ground constrained by artillery and missile systems in both of those countries, both of those areas, and very difficult to punch through, or through the Baltic, which is to some degree controlled by missile, anti-ship missiles in Kaliningrad. With NATO now having access to Sweden and Finland, you've got that northern route, so you can reinforce the Baltics through there.
Right.
That's important, but it also means, of course, that if you have a conflict in the Baltic, instantly you have dragged the whole of the high north into that conflict, mm-hmm. that is inherently going to be part of that fight.
All right. So just taking you back a couple of seconds, James, a couple of minutes actually, we talk about operating in Arctic conditions, talk about special oils and so on.
Yeah.
Let's just talk a bit longer about this, because I think, as you said, this is going to be part of the reason why lead times and opportunities to find indicators in open sources is going to be comparatively strong than other conflicts within the land. What are the challenges created by living, working, fighting in the Arctic environment?
Simply living there is a chore in itself. It is extremely difficult. I've only spent a little bit of time up in the high north. I've done some adventurous training with the army. I've been up on exercise with the Norwegians. But that was a command-based exercise, so I was mostly in a bunker for most of that time. But temperatures dropping below 20 degrees, minus 20 and below, that's cold.
Yeah.
And you will die if you don't know what you're doing. Interesting what some of the Norwegians told us is that actually that was probably the safest time of year, because winter, it's just cold and it's dry.
Okay.
So long as you've got the right equipment, so long as you've got some training and you're not stupid, you're probably going to be okay.
I'm out of it then. Completely out of it.
Come spring, you've got a lot of snow, a lot of ice on the ground. That melts during the day. you get wet, it freezes at night, and you die. It's that brutal. And so the discipline for individual servicemen to just, or service personnel rather, to just stay looking after themselves is a huge challenge. And you can't just take any troops who haven't been integrated into that environment.
Yeah.
And you also have to have a lot of equipment that is adapted or designed for the area. So even things like your gloves, your warm kit is a key requirement. If you look at a Royal Marine, his left glove is basically a big mitten. He's got more fingers on the right glove, so he can actually operate his weapon. But you hold your weapon fundamentally differently.
Hmm.
And then you've got to learn to ski cross-country. This is pretty demanding stuff. We also look at things like logistics. There just aren't a lot of settlements up in the High North. So you can't requisition stuff. You can't live off the land. You have to bring everything with you.
Logistic support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not the easiest terrain for trucks to get across.
Sure.
Winds and high weather can be storms can be an issue in some parts of that area as well. So just surviving is very difficult. Resupplying the troops is very difficult. Lots of vehicles that you would use elsewhere aren't going to work for one reason or another. We can't really be sure what would work without taking it up there and trying it.
Yeah. And by so doing, you're demonstrating an intent.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if we were to see a whole load of next generation battle tanks suddenly exercising in Norway, or just a little bit east, that'd be a pretty good indicator.
Yeah. So it seems to me then the conditions almost demand that the lead time to arrive and to fight is more than a short period of time, unless you are very well prepared. Very well prepared means you've got to demonstrate you're intending to be prepared.
Absolutely, yeah.
The intent would be, Sean, to your point, one of those things that become clear in political discourse, particularly if the seas start breaking up and international sea lanes start being debated. You've got this set of indicators that are starting to emerge from discourse in the public and political domains. You've got indicators in terms of capability developments, testing going on, and because people love social media, they'll be reporting that inadvertently all the time by here's me in the High North, here's me at the North Pole. I'm sure we get plenty of military tourism going on with that. But it does strike me though that the amount of capability you could take to the High North and persist in the High North doesn't feel like you'd be able to do that. And the same as you do the German planes, for example. You pour capability into those parts of the world, and then they would requisition local food supplies and logistics would be there and so on. That's just not true in the Arctic. I mean, sustainment alone would be a major impediment to a conflict.
And that's back to why I think the Arctic is a perfect target for indication and warnings, because you're going to see all that ramping up.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll come and talk about what we think is going to happen shortly. Mm. But, other than for political reasons, small touch points, the usual miscalculation, which tends to be not miscalculation, it's just I wonder what they're going to do if we do this. I think all that. And of course, as James eloquently put it, surviving there is hard enough. Operating your whichever piece of capital equipment you've got is hard enough. Joining it up together within even your own domain is hard enough. And then you've got to do combined arms. As we've seen in, and this is another podcast for another day, lessons learned in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Combined arms are really, really hard.
Yeah.
Doing it in those austere environment is even harder, actually.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean to say that there is not going to be a tension point.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, let's then get into our crystal ball gazing. We've talked about the amount of time it might take to prepare and the indicator warnings that might be given to us, available to us to sense that starting to build. What do you see as the likely? You mentioned 2030 for the Chinese, 4 or 5 years after Ukraine's finished, or whatever that might be, for Russia. What are your thoughts? What does the next 10, 15 years look like for the High North?
I think the possibility of a miscalculation that's not quite a miscalculation is very likely, and that could happen quite soon.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Russia has been doing in even in recent months is just moving border, the dragon's teeth concrete blocks that mark the border with Finland and elsewhere. They've just moved them a few metres in, on the assumption that actually no one's going to start a war over that. But of course, actually, a grumpy border guard who's been on a 12-hour shift and has been told he's not going to be relieved for another four, who goes and does his patrol and finds some Russians inside his country and decides to take a shot, a couple of pot shots at them, is perfectly possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I think, there's a scope as more previously icebound land opens up. There's scope for countries to lay claim to it. Similar, going back to 1982 with what the Argentinians did with the old whaling stations in the South Georgia, arriving there to do some sort of economic activity as civilians, probably be tolerated by the country that's there rather than to create a fuss, but possibly not, and then decide to put up their own flag and reveal that, of course, they're not actually civilians. and this is now Russia. It's probably going to be Russia, I think. Yeah. It could be someone else. It's unlikely to be a conflict between any of the Arctic nations other than Russia. You may be aware that Canada and Denmark had a long-standing dispute over an island, and each year or every couple of years, they would send a military patrol, land on the island, march inland, raise their flag, and they'd leave a bowl of spirits for the others for when they next arrived and swap the flag over. these things between Denmark and America and the UK and others, these things are going to be resolved peacefully. It's Russia is the Arctic nation that is the issue.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Sean, what are your thoughts?
So I largely agree with that, actually. I think that it will be something small and territorial, South Georgia, etc. But for me, that will be a political thing to see what the reaction is going to be. So it's the boiling frog analogy. We do this, not got away with that. Do this, got away with that. But it'll be for a bigger reason. So there will either be an economic imperative because of natural resources, which is some way away, or it'll be part of a bigger strategy. You know, say, for example, Russia is successful in annexing some of Ukraine, but then that border is stabilized for whatever reason. The likelihood is that they will want to push somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that somewhere else could well be the high north. Do I think there's going to be a really major conflict in the high north? Probably not, for all the reasons that we've said, certainly not for a long time. And we would see that coming.
Yeah.
But it's going to be very much a point of inflection point and a flashpoint that is deliberately fomented by one of the countries. The nuance to that, this is why it's global, is that, while China and Russia are, at the moment apparently getting on quite well, this is a potential tension point between them, because China's Northern Silk Road, as they are talking about and developing capability to do it, if the Russians take exception to that, that will be a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of transactional relationships going here. So this is why I'm fascinated by the High North, because it really does reflect all the global tensions and security challenges in one scenario.
Yeah. I do wonder how much attention the High North gets in the average day of the capitals that we care about, this side of the table and indeed the other side. I wonder how much attention is given to it. It's clear that some must be, because we've heard about activity, capability development, but with all eyes on the obvious parts of the world, in Africa, in the Middle East, in East Europe, from our perspective anyway, those are the obvious places to talk about. I wonder how much of the same countries are staring north into the Arctic region.
Yeah, and I think this is, particularly some of the Arctic states themselves and some of our allies, I think they deliberately, you will hear people say, what you're talking about, High North is fine, it is an area of peace zone, leave it alone. But I personally think the reason they're saying leave it alone politically is because they're worried about what could happen there. I think the right people are worried about it, but I think that they are in the open anyway, turning it down, certainly diplomatically and politically.
I can definitely see, from what we said today in the last half an hour or so, the opportunity for conflict, from the ambiguities and the interpretations and the opportunity, economic as well as navigation opportunities, that are rising. But I can equally see that the actual likelihood, as you said, Sean, of a significant military engagement being very much either signaled as is coming because of the capability build, or more likely not happening, it being a much smaller engagement happening. All right, well, as ever, time will eventually evaporate, and I said it has done so. I'll just ask a very simple question and give you time to think about it, James.
if you had one thing you want to leave an audience with as they go away from this podcast with regards to the High North, what would it be? And while you're thinking of that, I'll throw that to Sean. For me, one of the things that this strikes me as being is one of those scenarios that not enough people were thinking about, and suddenly it became a problem, and now everyone's thinking about it. Everyone's now staring at it and wondering why the hell something wasn't done sooner. It just feels like one of those grey areas of not yet conflict, but could become a conflict area very quickly. Well, I say very quickly, I'm contradicting myself. I said earlier it would take a long time. Yes, but conflict at a low end of the scale, you know, ships harassing one another in the waters, that would certainly draw the eye very quickly and wondering why the hell we hadn't done something about it before. So for me, that's the one takeaway I've got, is how easy it would be for it to become a conflict area, low-end conflict, and yet it's not getting a lot of attention. What about you, Sean?
And my point would follow on from that, actually, to say that, you know, I've mentioned it before already on the podcast, is this is a great subject for developing an indicator and warning matrix. If I was James, I would be putting together an IW matrix. But you can't know what's abnormal until you've been monitoring something over a period of time.
Something we do.
Trend analysis, stuff like that. I know you're already doing that, James, but you know, this is a fantastic subject where the open source intelligence can really make a difference, because even what people are looking at, and however much they are looking at it from a classified perspective, which isn't that great actually, you know, an open source organization can actually get into that granularity, keep looking at it, and so there isn't a surprise at the end of it.
The enduring look.
Indeed.
The enduring look. James?
I think it's the fact that we've got this confluence, which means that right now, actually, we're probably not going to see, we're not going to see serious fighting breaking out in the next year or two. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But we've got increasing accessibility to resources. Those resources increasing in value. The cost of extracting them coming down. Underlaid with the tensions between those countries, one of those countries and the other seven, and also other players. It's not going to happen today, but in 10 years' time, this is going to look a very, very different scenario. Mm-hmm. And as we said, the leading times to be prepared are not short.
They're not trivial.
So we need to be preparing today to look out, you know, what may be happening in 10 years.
Tomorrow. Yeah. James, thank you. And Sean, thank you for raising the topic. Really interesting topic. If any of the listeners would like to know more about that, then please send us a question. We'd be more than happy to answer if we could, or indeed generate new podcasts out of it. But James, in all sincerity, thank you.
Thank you. There will be a paper coming out on this through James as well in the near future.
Okay.
And a webinar as well at some point.
Very good. Thanks, James. Yes. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.